Hello, everybody, and welcome to Awakenings. Awakenings is a podcast that invites us all to share a wider story of the human family. We're delighted to be in conversation with leading systems thinkers as we ask ourselves this question as leaders, as people, how do we navigate a crisis of such magnitude that it threatens our existence? What will our legacy be for our human family? We'll be looking at the roots, really, of how we ended up here, in the context of how we use that learning, this wider story, to help us shape a brighter future, to change the choices that we make for the world that we want to have. I'd very much like to acknowledge our elders, our ancestors, the people who in some ways suffered greatly. But if we can learn from their experiences, we can transform that into something that will light us really forward to a much brighter path. I'd also really like to recognise Foundation Nova Diem for their huge generosity in making this podcast possible. Thank you to all of you, and thank you for listening. Well, it's an absolute delight to be here on the Awakenings podcast. And this episode, we're going to be looking at how we move from egocentric to ecocentric. How do we restore balance with a feminine worldview? And there's nobody I would like to have that conversation more with than with Mamta. Mamta Bogari is the executive director of She Changes Climate. And you've just got a phenomenal track record, Mamta, in enabling women to take a full place in the world. Mamta has been named one of the top 10 women leaders in 2023 in India. She has an incredible track record of enabling women to gain full access to education, to healthcare, to sustainable livelihoods. I hope we'll cover some of the incredible things that you've done in your work, Mamta. And I think that the main focus of your work now with She Changes Climate is committed to promoting gender parity and women's leadership in climate decision making. So really delighted to have this chat with you, Mamta. What we'd like to explore really is how the exclusion of women has been entrenched in a patriarchal worldview that has really authorized this pillage of Mother Earth that has brought us, you know, to this really critical place where we're facing, you know, almost an existential crisis. And I think it's that absence of balance between this hugely agentic dominator model and this divine feminine that has led to this accelerated breakdown in our climate and in our biodiversity. So our conversation will be kind of exploring the history of how we got here and very much how we can move forward by including the women who've been excluded. And that with such a focus on the women of the global south and the marginalized communities who really do bear the brunt of the changing climate and of the changing, you know, ecosystems on our planet.
Yeah, thank you so much, Cindy. An absolute pleasure to talk to you. And in fact, I'm privileged because the amount of work, the immense work that you are doing and very important work that you're doing is something has been, you know, I've been learning every single day since we have known each other. So thank you so much for this conversation. And you're so right in terms of, you know, just this whole moving from egocentric to ecocentric. And, you know, I was just thinking, reflecting upon it, and again and again, it comes to my mind in 1949 when Simone de Beauvoir talked about the other half, women as the other half. And today, generation and years later, we still remain the other half. And the statistics, you know, people talk about evidence. People talk that these are abstract theories. These are feminist theories. But look at what data says. And, you know, if I just look at the World Economic Forum 2023 Global Gender Gap Report, it says 131 years to reach gender parity at the rate that we are going. It isn't that. I mean, this is like crazy. We are talking from 1949 to even now. You know, we remain not the other half, but we remain actually completely ignored and almost made invisible in this whole narrative that has happened. What fascinates me about your work and this conversation, Cindy, I know that your work includes telling stories and it enables people to develop a different perspective on world so that we can develop a way of living here and we can talk about a thriving future. We can manifest a thriving future. very interested to understand, and it'll help me if you can give a background to what you think how colonization has really excluded women and the feminine worldview.
Well, you know, thanks, Mamta, and also thank you for your lovely comments. It's absolutely mutual. Every time I speak to you, I come away a much more enlightened and wiser person. And actually, on that word enlightened, that's probably where I'm going to start with this story. We talk about the Age of Enlightenment, and that was also known as the Age of Reason. It was an age that lacked reason in much of the, for many reasons. You know, it was talked about a time when philosophical principles of liberty, of government, of religious freedom, of rights as an individual, really came to the fore. But these were not applicable to women, nor to people of colonized countries. So in a way, you've got this, you know, these philosophers or these, you know, the people who are shaping the cultural narrative of the time, who can only understand that a tiny percentage of the human family, you know, that's people in the global north, male, who belong to an elite. They're the only type of creatures on this planet that have the right to these, you know, to think, to feel, to be. Women at that time, this is, you know, this is very much the Age of the Enlightenment is the height of colonial expansion. They had no right to vote, to sue, to own property. They effectively just became chattel of their husbands. So when colonial expansion began, regardless, I'll come back to talk about that. You know, what happened to the actual land itself? There was constitutional exclusion in any of the colonies that were set up. You know, they were not, there was the, ironically, there's the Statue of Liberty in the United States, but there was no liberty for women. There were no rights. The women were still they're owned by their husbands pretty much with no right to vote. You know, if you look at some of the dates, women in Australia, they weren't elected to Commonwealth Parliament till 1943. It wasn't until 1965 that they had the right to drink in a public bar. In India, as you will know, Mamta, the British did everything they could to block women from voting. And so it wasn't until the country became independent in 1951, even though the women had, by, you know, global suffrage, most women in the UK, for example, women had got the vote in the 1920s. It wasn't until 1951, when the country was independent, that women were able to vote. So that it was just hard baked into the constitution. And the other thing I think is that was really a factor is the sheer barbarity with which the colonization happened. If you looked at, I'm reading a really interesting book at the moment by Bartolomé de las Casas, and he talks. It's an eyewitness account of the destruction of the of South America, the Caribbean, it mostly focuses around the Caribbean islands and South America, and it's absolutely barbarous with the decimation of people and land. And the acts are so atrocious, it's hard to even speak about them. And yet these men, if women had done things like that, they would have been called criminally insane. And this is things like keeping humans to be live dog food, to, you know, grilling children. The whole of Cuba was eradicated. The whole of what was Haiti now, the entire population was decimated. If women had done something like that, they would have been called criminally insane. But men called themselves conquistadores, so they called themselves these conquerors. And in this comes the myth of the hero. And in some ways, you need this feeble, incapable woman that you can go out and then be a hero because you're defending. Not only are you on this civilizing mission that is very much a theme of the Enlightenment, you know, the white man's burden, the manifest destiny, civilizing the savages, you know, you're doing this incredibly heroic job, but you're defending helpless women and children too. And so the more brutal, in a way, this dominator model it unfolded, the more helpless women needed to seem to be. You know, you see that in the Southern belles, in the brutality of the Southern plantation system. You've got these incredible belles in their little, what we call toilet roll cover dresses, these frilly little dresses who can barely move without assistance. And it's, you know, that's all pushing women into this to fulfill this narrative of this great hero, you've got to have this incredibly feeble woman who can't do very much. And you see that in colonization, because whenever the colonizing powers encountered matriarchal power or matrilineal societies, they did everything they could. And that was in India, the Nairs, the Seneca people in America, the Iroquois, the, you know, all, the many, many places where women had agency, where they had political power, where they had a key role in their societies. Whenever that was encountered by colonization, they did everything they could to dismantle it. It was a gradual erosion of that, of matriarchal power. It was not tolerable in the story that the colonizers were telling. I could go on. But even in Christianity itself, it's probably the most anthropocentric religion, because it sacralizes in this egocentric. It puts man at the apex of God's creation, and it desacralizes nature. You know, nature is this inert mass, and everything else is under the dominion of man. That is the teaching of, or at least as it was interpreted, of the Christian religion at that time. And you've got people like Francis Bacon, that, you know, that really horrendous. He says nature must be taken by the forelock, lay hold of her, capture her, conquer her and subdue her, shake her to the foundations. You know, they use language, you know, really almost of sexual conquest and rape whenever they talk about women. In colonization itself, talked about virgin territories, virgin land. There was no such thing. These lands were populated by highly functioning societies right across the world. So the whole justification for colonization is built in the repression of any other form of intelligence, really, apart from white global north males. So I think, but trying to understand how we got here, it's important to unpick that story, because it's woven its tentacles into almost every element of our lives. You know, when Hollywood starts to become ascendant in the early 1900s, that's the myth that it tells. You know, you've got these incredibly, you know, delicate women who look, sit around looking, you know, incredibly glamorous and wonderful, but they don't actually do very much. You know, their only role is to be the sex, the love interest. Meanwhile, men are there conquering and making safe the land by killing the Indians, the cowboys and Indians rift that goes through all of it. It's so embedded in how we were taught to think, that unless we actually are able to recognize that, it's pretty hard to pull out of it, Mamta, as I'm sure you know, you're fully aware of. So that's why, for me as a storyteller, it's really, really important to recognize those, the stories that we have been told are truths, and actually look at them as for what they are, which is stories.
Exactly. And the important, and as I hear you, as I listen to you, Cindy, you know, the power of narratives, you know, whether if you look back to colonization, how the narratives were framed, you know, you look at Industrial Revolution, you look at the World War, you look at COVID, you know, it doesn't matter which part of history it happened, but you look at it, the way you framing the narratives in terms of the whole, and how beautifully explained about this whole thing about power and greed, which seems to put man in the middle with power and greed and moving ahead and developing and forming a narrative that actually, you know, almost puts women as a tokenism, you know, women standing there for certain needs that the men think that they could provide. And this narrative has been going on since we started thinking about economic growth and development. We started thinking about conquest. We started thinking about, you know, going and taking over lands that belonged to someone else. I mean, this whole narrative that you explained is there in all the conquests that happened, you know, on all the colonization process that happened throughout. And it's quite contrary to what is very, very natural and normal, which is about, you know, equality. It is about compassion. It is about identity. What it is about, resilience, power, nurture, everything that a woman stands for. And, you know, for centuries now, we are fighting something which is extremely natural. It's our being. It's like what we are as human. And therefore, your work of storytelling is very important, even when I think in my interaction with the youth of today, why it is so important for them to get this perspective of colonization and the feminine worldview in how they think, because, you know, I feel sometimes that they are excluded from this conversation because the entire education system is so geared to kind of, you know, look at ways ahead, growth, you know, look at, they leave behind what makes us being human being. And your work is very, very important in this. So it's really, really a privilege for me to know your work. And thank you so much for doing this work. I would also like to understand that, why does this work matter to you from a personal point of view, from a systemic level? What is, where do you gain your passion from?
Yeah, well, thanks again, Mamta. I mean, I'm, you know, obviously as a mother, you know, as a woman, I have a daughter, you know, it feels incredibly important that we do everything we can to make to shape a world where they have, you know, where they have the chance to bring the you know, the fantastic gifts that we all have, male and female, into the world. So to shift this, no, to shift this system. But I think that the statistic that you just gave at the beginning there, that it will take 135.6 years, I think it is, to close this gender gap. I mean, that's just unacceptable. And we're in such a, formulated it beautifully there. The climate crisis is born out of this desire for power, power over the planet, power over finite resources. It's coming out of this dominator model. So it often exacerbate issues related to gender and power, you know, such as poverty and access to education, to a decent quality of life. So it feels really imperative to shape a world where all of us can thrive, you know, to look at that and to bring in, when we talk about a feminine worldview, it's not just women think like that. It's that yin yang, that balance. So there's many men that want this type of world as well. But if you're just driven by that one arrow, which is greed, growth at any cost, which is really how we've got to this, you know, to looking our own extinction in the face, we have to now balance that by bringing back a much more holistic, ecological, systemic, if you like, feminine worldview. So that's what, you know, really drives me to be part of making this happen. To, you know, the brilliant scientist Lynn Margulis, she worked with James Lovelock to develop, and everyone says, oh, it's James Lovelock's Gaia hypothesis. It was actually Lynn Margulis who co-developed that with him. And that's looking at Earth as this self-regulating system, self-regulating living system. And it's that, in that understanding, we see that we can, instead of driving on one vector of power and growth, we can actually look at our world completely differently and understand that we have to be part of this nurturing of our own life support system. So that's what I would, you know, would call the feminine worldview. And I had the great good fortune, Monday or Tuesday, I don't know which day, a couple of days ago, to see Kate Raworth speak. And you actually, when you see how women conceptualize the world differently, heard that donut economics, you know, she's like, I saw the circle. And if you look at lots of indigenous and different cultural representations of the world, and balance is often a circle. Our, you know, great friend Christine McDougall, her centropic symbol is this circle. And it's not only just the visual power of it, but it's the intellectual power to see that you, Kate herself, you know, made the reference to Ptolemy when he's saying that he's in a time when Earth, again, egocentric, is at the center of the solar system. And there's Copernicus there going, like, you know, it's not, it's the sun. that's at the center of the solar system, obviously, and the planets. But he daren't say anything because the time is so dangerous, for, you know, for you to, it's almost heresy to say that. But you know, that's what people like Lynn Margulis did, what like Kate Raworth did, and they flipped it on their head. You can't have economics at the heart of an, Earth, the death of Earth is a byproduct of economics. I can't remember the correct economic term for it. But our Earth is our economic, you know, our economic system has to be based around what Earth can support. And I'm not saying it's only women that are capable of thinking like that, but when you get out of that vector of power, of growth, of dominion, you start to see the world, you're able to understand and see the world in this much more symbiotic way, you know, set of relationships. And so out of that comes these feminine, if you like, balanced, harmonious ways of living here that we absolutely have to achieve. Otherwise, you know, we do, I think Earth is wounded, she'll survive, but we as a species don't get to stay around, I don't think, Mamta.
Mm-hmm. No, and this becomes particularly relevant now, looking at the crisis that we are in globally, you know, and when you bring up this whole issue of yin and yang, and you bring up this issue of feminine and masculine energies, I think there is no time than now when we really need that balance. And, you know, it's very fascinating to see that the one worldview of growth, greed, power, you know, is growing at an exponential rate where there seems to be no control. Whereas this worldview of getting back to where we started with, which is the Earthland movement, which is talking about feminine energy, masculine energy, talking about balance, is also growing, you know, equally. The pace obviously is very different because there's a whole lot of, as you had explained, how narratives are built. So the narratives so far right now, the worldview is so geared towards this growth, power, greed, that this worldview, which seems to be bringing us back to where we belong, you know, it's almost like centering ourselves. We kind of have moved away from our center, and that is the Earth. And therefore, you know, it's beautiful to hear your perspective and how you view the entire balance between, you know, the feminine energy and the masculine energy as well, and Earth. I wanted to understand from you, particularly given your work, so, you know, intensive work on the feminine worldview as well as on climate change. How do you see the synergies between colonization, climate change, and in terms of just the future? How do you see that? How do you position this colonization, climate change, and making sure that women are represented at least equally? There's this huge movement. What is your perspective on it? Where do you position yourself in this view?
Yeah, well, thanks again, Mamta. And I think, as you say, it's recognizing those, you know, we've got the UN Sustainable Development Goals, which I think are, you know, a really important step on creating a roadmap to how we get out of here. But I think the one danger of those is that people think that you can tackle these things individually. It's so clear that they're intertwined. If you know, to solve climate change, we need to look at how women are represented. To understand, you know, how we got to climate change or why women are in that position, we have to understand the legacy of colonization. So that the things are really intricately linked. And, you know, climate change does impact everybody, but women, and I'm so interested to talk about your work, Mamta, because, you know, you're providing the solutions to this. Women and girls are so disproportionately affected by it, and yet they have the least, because of the colonial history, because of the way that our societies are structured, they have the least say, the least voiced in terms of how we solve these problems. And yet women are incredibly resilient, and they've been working at they've had to incorporate living with these problems in their lives. And so the solutions are clearly going to come from the people, or some of them, the solutions that are, who are having to deal with this just as an integral part of their existence. And, you know, unfortunately, climate change is a threat multiplier. So it means it escalates social, political, and economic tensions in in the settings that where we're, again, women are most vulnerable, obviously fragile societies, which are conflict, which are affected by conflict. So you're even having to look at those connections as well when you're looking at trying to solve these problems. And yet these are problems that affect women so much. And yet if you look at the table, who's around the table trying to solve them, women are absent. So it feels absolutely critical now to meaningfully incorporate Global South women into environmental narratives as agent of change, as bearers of knowledge. No, all women, but particularly women that have been more excluded than most and who have been dealing with this all their lives. They kind of have a lived knowledge of how we of the type of ecological policy that we need to develop to both understand the question, the issues, and find the solutions for them in a way that makes the connections, not just looking in the silos. How do we get carbon out of the atmosphere? How do we build sustainable cities? How do we? You have to have this knowledge of everything, and women have held society together even in these marginalized positions. If you look at the glue in almost every culture and every society, it's women. And so they carry the knowledge of how to make things collaboratively, how to do things collaboratively. And at the moment, it's not at the moment, for over history, they're the ones who have been at the really sharp end of climate change. And so with not including those voices and not including that knowledge, it's like trying to ride your bicycle when you only think that there's a handlebar. You can't see the whole rest of the machinery behind it. So Mamta, that really brings me onto that. I hope I'm looking at how we got here, what happened to us, what is the story, what is the wider story of this human family. And, you know, it is one that the invisibility of that story has left us in a place that we don't really know fully what's happened to us. So we don't really know where to look for the answers. But you are really working on making that story visible, bringing in these voices. And I'm so delighted to know you and to be here with you, because it's all very well to expose the problems, but unless somebody's actually doing something about it, again, it leaves us with this sense of disempowerment. But women like you, people like you, are innovating solutions in territory that we've never really been in before, Mamta. So I wonder if you could give us a little bit of an overview of your work at She Changes Climate and how you work to include people who have been so marginalized, and how you believe that recognizing the root of this problem makes us more effective at creating systemic change.
So, you know, for all the reasons that you mentioned, all the narratives that you talked about of why it is important to have female there, She Changes Climate starts with, we work with a basic premise that women does not just deserve a position in the leadership role. Women, we have a right to be there at the leadership role in equal proportion, because we are 50% of the population. And for us, this is not the She Changes Climate is an advocacy for rightful position that women have, not deserves, have in decision-making in the climate space. It's unfortunate even now, you know, since it's been 28 years since the Convention of Parties started, we have just 5 women presidents. The percentage of women in climate negotiation, particularly in COP, is about 32% this year. But it was much, it has actually fallen down in COP27 28 as compared to 27 from 34. In the country delegations, women are less than 20%, in terms of their representation. And a very interesting statistics, because this is what is important to also understand. Is it important to just have women delegates in in your team. In out of these 20% women members who were there, almost less than 30% got a chance to speak. In 70% of the time, it were the men who were speaking in all these meetings. These are not made up stories. These are not anecdotes. This is pure data. And this is the premise with which She Changes Climate started as an advocacy movement. It started initially as a campaign to promote women equally as shared leadership in all climate decision making process. Today, the campaign is a movement. We realized in the last 3 years of our work that this is the She Changes Climate advocacy movement to bring women leadership equally at negotiation table is a global movement. And therefore, we also understand and recognize the important role of those women who are at the forefront of climate change, who are actually not just impacted. And as you mentioned, Cindy, they are also the solution providers. But their voices are completely ignored in this whole process of climate decision making. She Changes Climate is a platform to bring also, you know, the voices and amplify the voices of these women leaders who are at the forefront and bring them into the global negotiation process. We are working on three pillars. The first pillar is top-down policy, where we are really, really doing active climate policy diplomacy to get more and more women being represented in the COP presidencies at UNFCCC level. Through our inclusion and diversity pledge, where we are really, really talking about having more and more countries sign the inclusion and diversity pledge, saying that we're going to have more women, equal women members in our team. The other part is the bottom-up approach, where we are now really deepening the movement by making this movement of those countries who are at the level of impact, you know, who are impacted by climate change. So we are now deepening the movement at national levels in different parts, particularly in the global south. And for all the reasons that the conversation that we are having, you know, how colonization and marginalization, vulnerability, the increasing vulnerabilities of global south makes it difficult for women in the global south to actually emerge out, whether it is in terms of their voices, whether in terms of the amazing leadership that exists. You know, I have to say that I have myself working at the grassroots. I have seen amazing women leaders at the forefront in Asia. And why are they not there when the decisions are being made about their lives? Mm. You know, what we are trying to do is work with these women leaders at country level. We are kind of developing a platform to bring different organizations and different stakeholders who are working on climate change together and provide a space to do active advocacy, which is owned, co-created by in each country by the women leaders. And also to kind of, very importantly, and you talked about the circle, something that even as a woman leader myself, I have felt that sometimes, you know, you have to be so strong that there is no space for the care and support that you might require as a leader to go ahead and carry on the impact. And sometimes it drowns us. It really, really weakens us. She Changes Climate is also understands the power of providing that care and support to women leaders and to create a safe environment where we can really build each other strengths and resilience and work together. So that's a part of work. The middle part of our work, which is the crucial part, is our public campaigning work, which is the education part, which is the amplifying the voices of the work that is happening at the forefront. The entire work of She Changes Climate is built on the intersectionality that exists between climate and gender. We recognize that how climate change is impacting women disproportionately. There is enough data that exists now that actually talks about it in terms of, you know, because often you're asked, are these any, where is the data? Is this what you're talking about, just a story? No, it's not a story. Every story is a data, is evidence. And there is enough evidence now to say that women are disproportionately affected by climate change in times of flood. You know, 14 times more unsafe and lose their lives. I will quote one data about, to understand the intricacies that exist in this entire, when we categorize women and say when women are impacted, but women are impacted in a very deeper way. Last year's flood in Pakistan itself, you know, 77% of those women who were pregnant had gave birth in an open without any medical facilities. 90% of the last 3 years' data in Bangladesh, 90% of women, they are the ones who lost everything. They lost everything, you know. So there's enough data to talk about it. And this is another thing that we really want to highlight, the intersectionality piece in climate and gender, which is often not talked about, you know, while we are talking about climate action.
Yeah, that's so powerful what you're saying there, Mamta. And it's such interesting points about even like re-examining what we understand as leadership. I think there was that fantastic Wellbeing Alliance, world leaders were invited to be part of it. The only leaders that were part of it were women: Finland, Scotland, New Zealand, Wales. I can't remember all the countries, but interestingly, it was all women that saw this need for a different type of leadership, as embodied to an extent by Jacinda Ardern. And then when you talk about data, it's shocking what people don't see as visible in front of their eyes. You know, every time I see that photograph of the family photograph of the world leaders at COP, you know, that tells the whole story. As you've said, you're looking for 2, 3, 4, maybe 5 women out of 193 world leaders. So it's, you've explained so clearly what you're doing on a kind of planetary level. So how can organizations take this on board? First of all, be more conscious of how to of the exclusion of women, and what would your advice be, because it's clearly at every organizational level that you have end up with a world leadership group. The G20 is the same, you know, the total absence of women. So what would your advice be to organizations and companies who want to benefit from everything that you've outlined here, that women bring to organizations, to leadership, to well-being, to prosperity in a much more wider dimension than simply profit? Yeah, how can this be done in a genuine way that has real impact?
So I think every time I think about it, I think about that at the end of COP, we have this whole picture, as you said, that there, you know, hardly any women there, full of men. I think that is one picture. And look at it, a part of my heart sinks, but a part of my, you know, heart comes up with this immense, fierce compassion, if I may say so. It's a fierce compassion to change it. Now look at this picture and look at the world around you. Look at leadership. There is a leadership crisis going on in the world.
Oh, totally, yeah.
Totally. And, you know, and you look at any corner where there is crisis, these are masculine energies, if I may say so, which is driving. And which is of power and greed and, you know, of inhuman acts. And there is a leadership crisis, and therefore there is a need. This has not worked. This pattern has not worked. Clearly, this has to be changed. And I think that increasingly organizations that are working at the ground have to internalize that conviction. This change has to happen, number one. And I think for all of us here, we also need to recognize that this crisis is so immense, and it is so huge, and there is so much of urgency in it, that if we try to remain in our silos and if we try to alone work towards it, we will not reach there. So for any organization, I think it is important to understand the power of collectives. Collaboration is, I think, we just cannot do without collaborations. We have to get together. You know, we need different skills. We need to create that collaborative, collective force which can only address this crisis. And therefore, I think for all organizations, it is what you started with. How do we move from an ego center to eco center? You know, how do we come out of our own self and look at the larger cause? So I think that it is very important to define those things as an organization and be, because there's a risk of becoming tokenist in nature. So you might have right policies, might have the right, but you might not actually be demonstrating the values that you really want to. So for every organization, I think it is a question that we need to ask ourselves again and again. Are we really walking the talk in terms of the values? Are we demonstrating the values of collaboration, you know, decolonization, or are we just being tokenistic in our approach? So we have to move from that tick mark of having one woman in your team, maybe somebody, two women from the global south in your team, and they have a role, no responsibility, no decision-making. Yeah. We have to change the So these are some of the things that I think are very important for organizations.
Yeah, well, thank you, Mamta. That really is, you know, great advice. Just it really embedding it. And I'm, you know, when I'm, it's kind of shocking in a way that you're asked to produce this data when that photo, exactly as you said, 193 or however many world leaders, total absence of women, 28 years, and we're in the biggest mess humanity's ever faced. And, you know, that is a huge piece of data alone. Who was making these decisions? Who was absent? So you've done this tremendous job. I've had such a wonderful time talking to you. I can't believe that we're almost at the end of our time for today, Mamta. But it's been so fantastic to, you know, to have the benefit of your incredible experience and wisdom. And you've developed this powerful, you head up this really powerful organization to bring women to the forefront of deciding how we face this daunting existential challenge. We are really at the 11th hour, but there is hope that we can change this. There are other roads open to us, as you've said, through collaboration, through understanding our past to build this much better future. So it's critical work that you're doing. Can you tell us how we can be part of supporting you, anybody who's listening to this as an individual or as a company, an organization? What can we do to help with this really vital mission?
So I would say become a part of the movement. This movement is She Changes Climate is a movement that is everybody's movement. It is not about an organization. We have to make it our movement. And to make it our movement, I think each one of us can make a difference personally, and by joining the movement, bring your skills, bring your experience, bring your insight, and let us come together and create a movement which is owned by all of us, which a movement which does not, you know, does not put us in a corner saying this is a global south movement, this is a global north movement. This is a movement of all of us. We own it across geographies. We own it with love, care, nurture, compassion, and most importantly, a movement which demonstrate the immense resilience of women, of feminine energy, if I may say so, that the world requires right now. Come and join the movement. That's what I would say to everyone.
Well, that I don't think we can end on a more beautiful invitation, Mamta. Thank you so much for spending the time, taking the time out of your critical work to speak to us today. It's been such a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Cindy. As usual, every conversation with you, I go back inspired and motivated. Thank you for this conversation.
Thank you. You've been listening to the Awakenings podcast. Thank you so much for tuning in. If you've enjoyed what you've heard, please do share the podcast, and you can visit my website. It's www.cindyford.com. I'd like to thank everybody who's been part of this, our wonderful systems thinkers who have joined us. And I'd really like a special thanks to go to Foundation Nova Diem, who've made this podcast possible. It's been such a pleasure to share this time with you. Thank you so much for listening.